Welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. It's been a year since the attacks of September 11th happened in New York and Washington. And all week long, we've had ceremonies and memorials all across the nation. But how will the events of 9/11 be remembered in 5 years? How about in 50 or 100 years? Tonight, we're going to talk about how events become history, how the immediacy of today takes its place in the sequence of time, first reported, then analyzed, and finally placed in context as the years roll on, often to be revived and revised somewhere down the road. Now, following the discussion, we'll hear excerpts from a lecture on the African-American search for freedom in the American West, an example of how history becomes more understood as time goes on. But first, a look at the question of how history is recorded. We're joined by Professor Anna Geifman from the College of Arts and Sciences, whose field is Russian and Soviet history, and whose works include Thou Shalt Kill, Revolutionary Terrorism in Russia, 1894 to 1917. And we're joined by Professor Bruce Schulman, director of the American and New England Studies Program, whose field is 20th century U.S. history, and whose works include The 70s, The Great Shift in American Culture, Society, and Politics. Professor Geifman, Professor Schulman, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Ted.
Good to be here.
Barbara Tuchman called journalism the first rough draft of history. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think I see what she's getting at, and that's a familiar phrase, but I don't think it's quite right. I'd be more comfortable saying that it's not so much the rough draft of history as one of the raw materials of history among many others. And a couple of differences, I think, really stand out just between the way the journalist approaches telling the story of what happened and the way the historian is. And one of them, of course, is that as historians, we know how the story turns out. And that gives us a whole different set of questions to ask and problems to research than somebody writing right at the time who doesn't, in the immediacy of events, doesn't really know how it's going to turn out. We also, of course, usually can have access to information that the journalist at the time doesn't have his or her hands on. I mean, if you were to compare, let's say, the war against terrorism to the long Cold War, well, in both cases, a lot of those struggles are going on in secret. They involve covert operations and secret negotiations that we're just starting to find out about from the Cold War now and that we won't know about what's going on for a generation at least.
So what's the process by which events move into history?
Well, maybe a little bit come back to this idea of journalism as being sort of a rough draft of history. You can sort of talk about journalism as a source or journalistic material as sources, because it's very, very important to understand what is being written about important historical events at the time of when these events take place, but we know, as Bruce just pointed out, you know, that if anything, any comment, any interpretation, any opinion about events that are very close, they have to be biased because they are too close. And because the journalists don't have the sources or the information to analyze these events with any degree of accuracy.
I mean, I think that's right. But I think we also then have to take the next step and to get away from the idea of history as somehow an unsullied, straightforward record of what happened when and why. And I think we have to remember that history is always going to be a kind of dialogue between the present and the past. And our interpretations of what happened are different in part because we're interested in different things. I mean, you mentioned this lecture that's coming up in the second half of the program about African Americans in the West, in the early West. And until a few years ago, no one thought there were any African Americans in the West. It wasn't that they were It wasn't that they were just discovered there. It was just that the kinds of questions we asked and the things we're looking for and the ideas we bring to that historical record are different. And so that causes us to find different things and revise that record.
And very similarly, you know, with the terrorists, for example, you know, in Russia at the turn of the century, there was a huge wave of terrorist activity. People don't know this, but there were, you know, 22,000 terrorist acts between the years 1904 to 1910, 17,000 of which were successful from the point of view of the terrorists, of course. You know, 17,000 people were killed and wounded. If you look at the at what had been written at the time, very seldomly, you know, you see the word terrorism. They were called freedom fighters, liberators of the mankind, of liberators of the poor, of the peasants, of the workers, saviors of the proletariat, anything but the terrorists. It's sometimes they would call themselves terrorists to promote the cause. This is a good thing.
Doesn't that argue that the winners write the history and we really, you know, don't necessarily know the full rounded story?
Well, in the case of Russia, definitely yes, because very little has been written about the terrorists precisely because the Bolsheviks, who were not considered the terrorist party, won in 1917. So all the other parties which were considered terrorist parties, such as the anarchists, the socialist revolutionaries, the maximalists, the losers, in quotes, well, they were actually losers, you know, but there was nothing about them.
They disappeared from history,
and not only from the Soviet historiography, but also from historiography in the West, because most of what has been written about history in the West was based on what was being written in the Soviet Union, because all the archives, all the sources, were there. So since nothing was published on these parties there, there was practically nothing.
So studying history is also a look at what's being left out.
Yeah, of course. But also remember that, you know, historians, like pretty much everyone else, you know, sometimes make their reputations, the sons and daughters make their reputations by knocking over the mothers and fathers. And so I don't think over the course of generations, it doesn't tell the whole story to say that the victors tell the history. Even just, I mean, the original American historians writing about World War II or the Cold War had a picture of the motives of the United States as being noble, of the Soviet Union being entirely evil, and so on. Whereas then, during the 1960s, a whole generation of revisionist historians suggested that the United States was to blame for the Cold War and that it was the economic imperialism of the United States that led to the Cold War, and they were writing the history of the Vietnam War back into earlier eras. So
what happens to events as time passes, as the times change, the way we look at the past changes? Does history get revised? And by whom? And why?
Well, I think it's very important to say that it's the historians who write history, and so it's essential to ask ourselves, you know, who is asking the question. So these questions obviously depend on, and what is being studied depends on our interests as historians, what we as not as historians so much, but as individuals are interested in this, in a particular time period, and, you know, with this whole idea, for example, this whole, well, I don't want to say fad, but, you know, the interest in social history, for example, or in revisionist history, for that matter, in at least in my field.
Okay, so let me step back for a minute here. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. Our guests are Professors Bruce Schulman and Anna Geifman of the History Department. We're talking about how history gets made. I'm sure that you try to be as honest as possible in writing your history, Bruce. How do you maintain detachment only to find maybe in 20 years from now somebody else says, well, a totally reinterpretation, the real truth is the following. How do you maintain that?
Well, I think all of us expect to be revised and reinterpreted in a generation. And in some ways, we wish for that because only if your work is relevant, someone is going to be asking new questions about it. And it's only if your work turns out to be uninteresting and irrelevant. I think, you know, historians have basically, I think, two different approaches to that problem of detachment. And I think there are people of good faith on both sides of that divide. On the one side are the people who say that you can never get away from who you are and where you sit, the biases and worldview you have, and so that your responsibility is just to lay that out on the table. At the beginning, say, here's where I'm coming from. These are my biases. These are my assumptions. This is my worldview, and evaluate what I have to say on the basis of that knowledge. There are others, and I think I put myself more in the second camp, who say, yes, of course, I have biases. I've had my own experiences, interests, teaching, etc. But I'm aware of that. And so to the best that I can, I have to try to correct for some of those biases. And the way that we try to do that, I think, is to make ourselves open to contrary evidence. Historians don't follow the old, you know, Baconian scientific method of just picking up the scattered data on the ground and then figuring out what it says. That would be impossible. We always go in with a set of questions and a set of assumptions or working hypotheses. And we would like to, and most of the time, to be honest, we do find the evidence that confirms our ideas. But I think we have to try to be open to the contrary evidence and allow ourselves to be surprised.
Anna Geifman, let me ask you. You know, you're the daughter of Russian emigres. You're fluent in both languages. You have a vested interest in the study that you're making of the former Soviet Union, Russian history. Is somebody in 20 years going to say, Anna Geifman got it wrong?
Of course. No question about it. But, you know, I'm probably on the other side of the argument. You know, I think it's practically impossible to get away from our biases. I think history is extremely subjective because it's not a computer-generated product. It's the historian as a person who is doing it, who is writing it. So just as we are largely unaware of our irrational motives or subconscious drives and interests in doing our daily things, in communicating with people, in acting the way we act, I think it also applies to what we do professionally, to what we do as historians. We cannot really. I don't know if we can control that.
Well, you asked, I think, of course, a couple of questions ago, how do events get into history? And, of course, that raises the question of what is an event? I mean, I'm not trying to say that there aren't things that actually happen. Of course they are. But the names we give them and the meanings we attach to them always involve an interpretation right there. And as we know, that there are many of the most dramatic events in history have very different names. I mean, you know, the American Civil War being one obvious example, and that involves two different interpretations of what the struggle was about.
All right, so as time passes, let's say more information becomes available, for example, the Soviet archives or declassified U.S. files. Are we seeing history corrected or broadened? Or what's happening with it as more information becomes available?
Well, I think it's all of those things and more, in fact, something more basic. I mean, sometimes things are corrected. There are some fairly straightforward empirical questions that can simply be settled by more information. Or there are some less straightforward questions, like about people's motives, that if we get contemporary documents of when they recorded what they were thinking, we have a firmer basis for interpreting their motives. So sometimes I think, yes, correction is part of it. We can get better information. But I think a lot of what's going on is that as we see how things have turned out, as we see what are the concerns today, because historians are often asking the question of how did we get where we are today? And so things that are happening now cause us to ask different questions about how we got here.
Mm-hmm. All right. So how does the emphasis on nationalism or political rivalry, you referred to that a little bit earlier, distort the larger picture. For example, the history of World War II places great emphasis on U.S. action in Europe, when it's now pretty clear that the Russian army, first at Stalingrad and then at Kursk, played the major role in defeating the German army. So how do political biases and or rivalries or nationalism affect our understanding of history?
Well, they do, because in the Soviet, well, in post-Soviet Russia, even today, when you have, I shouldn't say all archives are open, but many, many formally closed archives are open, and there are scores of new publications on 20th century Russian and world history. To this day, the Russians are convinced, most Russians are convinced, that they have won the war for the world. They don't even call it World War II. They call it the Great Patriotic War. So
you mean there's no mention of even any American effort there?
They, in scholarly publications, they mention the fact that America kind of participated a little bit, maybe, but they don't like that.
Uh-huh.
You know, the fact that I remember talking to some of my colleagues, and I mentioned the fact that all trucks used in Russia in the Soviet Union during World War II. American-made trucks.
200,000 Studebaker trucks.
Right.
Yeah.
And without which they couldn't have won. They couldn't.
Right.
They couldn't have done anything. And the expression was pretty sour. You know, they didn't really. They okay, fine. Well, all right, trucks. You know, but they just kind of wanted to end this conversation, close the topic.
The United States was the arsenal of democracy, as FDR put it, but the Soviet Union was the infantry, not necessarily of democracy, but at least of the Allies. Yeah, I mean, I think you've raised one interesting question, which is, and I mean, the study of history is still today organized very much along the lines of nation states. Most of us are experts in the history of one nation. For a couple of generations, professional historians have been trying to get people to think comparatively internationally. There's some very distinguished work there. But that certainly is in the minority. If you look at any history department, including ours at Boston University, it's pretty much organized by national histories. And I think that's in part because the nation state and nationalism and the discipline of history kind of grew up side by side in the 19th century, and at least the modern professional semi-scientific study of history, and was also and has been from the start. The professional study of history has been very much involved in the whole national project of trying to create, you know, stories of nationhood and peoplehood. So in some ways,
we're trying to get away with it a little bit.
We've been trying to get away with it, but that's sort of that's the thing that's way back in the baggage of the profession. And it still lingers, not in the way historians see the world, because we very much try to get out of that, but in the way our fields are organized and institutionally. And so the professional organizations, the departments, the granting agencies and so on,
the jobs, all
reinforce that kind of holdover from the 19th century.
All right, let's do something converse here. The end of the war in the Pacific, we were on World War II a little earlier, brought on by the use of the atomic bombs. At the time, it was reported as saving hundreds of thousands of lives, Allied and Japanese. Later, it was reported as an act of racist nuclear terror. So how does that happen? Is history really polemics under another name or special pleading in disguise?
Well, I think to take that example as a good one, right? That revisionist interpretation of atomic diplomacy being some of the arguments, I suppose, suggest that it was racism involved and that the United States never would have considered using the bomb if it had been against Europeans, even Germans. But there's another argument, which was that the bomb was unnecessary to end the war and that it was really targeted more against the Soviet Union and trying both to prevent the Soviet Union from entering the Asian War and seizing parts of Manchuria or that part of Asia, or was also meant to sort of be a show to the Soviets not to think about expansion in Eastern and Central Europe. So that's
anymore.
Well, and that's the argument. I mean, and so and a lot of that was, I mean, some of it was taking the same evidence that had been used before and reinterpreting it, because certainly Truman and his advisors did talk about ending the war before the Russians could get into the Pacific. They obviously were concerned about the situation in Europe. And in the speech that Truman made right after the Nagasaki bomb, he said, you know, we are not going to accept for any spheres of influence in Europe. And one sentence later said, and we are trustees of this new force, the bomb. And so people who were inclined to, I think, to take a critical view toward U.S. foreign policy could interpret that evidence. And that was really a product of the Vietnam War. It was the Vietnam War causing a generation who had grown up with it to have a rather dim view of U.S. foreign policy and to ask, where did this come from, and to find it there. I think also, and I think there's many of those questions in which, you know, it does take a while to figure out actually who the winners are and how something turned out. So, for instance, to go back to World War II, we now know that one of the most important effects of the Second World War for the United States domestically was the Civil Rights Revolution that came to full flower in the 1950s and the 1960s. A generation of people that served in military service came back with different attitudes about their place as citizens and a much more assertive understanding of how to get their rights. More than half a million people, African Americans, moved from the South to the North, and making the race problem no longer a regional aberration but a national problem. A whole different – and also the propaganda, the war aims of World War II, the fight for democracy and the Cold War after it made it embarrassing to have this system of segregation. So having known now that this was an outcome of World War II, we can look back at what was happening in the war and ask different questions about it, where in 1950 that hadn't happened yet. I can think of a similar question to ask about September 11th. So in the immediate follow-up and aftermath of September 11th, we saw an outpouring of religious sentiment across the United States. One of the first things that President Bush did was appear at a prayer service at the National Cathedral. Yet on the other hand, right, you might see the terrorist acts themselves as being inspired by a certain set of religious beliefs, however warped or inaccurate they are, and that might lead people to think about the role of religion in public life here in the United States in a different way. Already, I mean, one of the things that happens in September 11th is that President Bush's faith-based initiative, his plan to turn the provision of social services over to churches, that's died amid concerns about the separation of church and state, which I have to think the kind of theocratic sentiments of the perpetrators of this has to have played a part in.
And on that note, I think I'll thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor Bruce Schulman, Professor Anna Geifman on Boston University's World of Ideas, How History Gets Made and Remade. Thank you. We turn now to an example of how the passage of time and new research can change or at least modify the way history is viewed. The African American Studies Department recently played host to University of Washington history professor Quintard Taylor. Taylor spoke on the African American search for freedom in the American West. Here are excerpts from that lecture.
I teach a course on African American history in the American West, and I began that course with a simple premise. That premise is that there is no single African-American historical experience. The lives and histories of blacks in Mississippi or Boston obviously tell us much about the challenges that African-Americans face, but their stories give what I call an incomplete picture unless and until we know what happened elsewhere in the nation, including the American West. We need to know about the black historical experience in Helena, Montana, in Phoenix, Arizona, and in Seattle, Washington. Often we African Americans, and particularly those of us who were born in the South, tend to wrap ourselves up in what I call the authenticity banner, claiming that our experiences are the only real experiences of African Americans, that they are truer to the black world than anywhere else, and certainly than in those experiences of our Western cousins. I know this because I'm from the South, and when I first started teaching African American history, I did not talk about the West, and indeed, I publicly proclaimed, much in error, that there is no black Western history. I've since changed. Yet, if an African American grows up in a place like Seattle, that is his or her historical experience, and it is as valid as that of someone reared in Harlem or someone reared in Georgia. And unless we know all of these experiences, we can't possibly claim to truly understand African America. With that being said, I want to provide an overview, and that's all it will be today, a brief overview of the African American Western historical experience. It is impossible for me to talk in detail about that experience since it covers five centuries, but at least I will try to introduce you to certain concepts and certain experiences that reflect on a differing model of African American history. 10 years ago, in April of 1992, South Central Los Angeles exploded in anger and rage. Although Los Angeles is the largest metropolis in the West, those scenes of carnage broadcast on TV throughout the world undermine the regional self-image that most Westerners prefer. That image is of plastic valleys or broad vistas populated by proud citizens jealously guarding their individual rights and freedom, quote, under an open sky. Well, I would argue that black Western history, much like the Los Angeles uprising, intrudes itself onto our sensibilities and forces a reexamination of what historians of the West call the imagined West. That history, with its examples of resistance, cooperation, and conflict between African Americans and other Westerners, can be celebrated or it can be critiqued, but it can no longer be ignored. Unlike Asian American or Chicano or much of Native American history, which are almost automatically considered Western in orientation, black history in the region continues to be viewed by Western regional historians and by historians of the African American experience as an interesting footnote to a story that's focused elsewhere. Indeed, historian Walter Prescott Webb, one of the principal figures in, quote, modern Western history, wrote in 1957 that the West is the American region without, quote, water, timber, cities, or Negroes, unquote. This paucity of black Western scholarship is particularly surprising when we consider the size of the African American population at certain times in the history of the region. If we define the West, and I want you to take my definition of the West for just one moment. If we define the West as those states stretching from North Dakota south to Texas and then extending out to the Pacific and including Alaska and Hawaii, then as early as 1870, African Americans were 12% of the region's population. 12% of the region's population. Folks, that's about the percentage black people are now of the entire United States. Put another way, some 284,000 black people resided in every state and territory in the American West. By 1910, there were slightly less than 1 million black Westerners, and they were about 5% of the regional population. By the year 2000, there were almost 7 million black Westerners, and they comprised almost 7% of the regional total. Now, to be sure, it's easy to ignore the African-American presence in various areas of the West because that black presence is concentrated in certain regions or certain sub-regions or areas in the West. Let me give you an example of this. I lectured at the University of Idaho. I presented information on the black Western experience, and a co-ed came up afterwards, and she said, "This is all very interesting, but I grew up in Idaho where there are absolutely no black folks." Well, first of all, that's wrong. There are black populations, black communities that have been in Idaho for a very long time. But I could understand why she would say that because Los Angeles County, has more African Americans than all the people combined in Idaho. Think about that for a minute. There are more black people in Los Angeles County than there are people in the state of Idaho. She'd lived in an area where there were very few black folks. Ironically, one of the interesting features of African American history in the West is that the black population was more diffused, more spread out over the region in the 19th century than it would be in the 20th century. In the 20th century, we would see this extreme concentration of black people in relatively few places in the West. One of those places was Los Angeles. And the Los Angeles riot of 1992 made the nation painfully aware of the complex relationship between and among people of color in the modern American West. This was 10 years ago, so we all remember the conflicts between Asians and African Americans. We all remember the conflicts between blacks and Latinos, or between the Latinos and Asians. Yet very few commentators, very few television or newspaper experts tended to point to the history, the long history of these people, a history that in many instances was influenced by both conflict and cooperation over about five centuries. If we look at that history, then in some ways we could understand what happened in Los Angeles, and certainly we could predict what would happen in the future. Was the West significantly different for African Americans? Was there a Western racial frontier beyond which black people could expect both freedom and opportunity? The answer to this question is both yes and no. It is yes, as in the success of post-Civil War Western blacks in gaining and keeping voting rights everywhere in the region except Texas. And in the question and answer session, we may want to talk about why Texas was the exception. But that question must be answered with a resounding no if we consider the emergence of post-1865 discriminatory legislation symbolized by anti-miscegenation statutes, by public school segregation, and by various other legislation in states as diverse as Montana and Arizona and Oregon. Such ambiguity arising from African-American history in the West surely complicates the region's past. I argue that complication begins with the earliest African arrivals in the region. Consider, for example, Estevan, the Moroccan-born black slave who represented Spain as he ventured into New Spain's northern frontier, that is what is now Arizona and New Mexico, and in the process opened up the region to further Spanish exploration and eventually colonization. Or take the example of Isabel de Alvera, the black woman who settled in Santa Fe, New Mexico in 1600, and thus became, as far as we know, the first free black woman to enter the West. And as Professor Richardson said, she entered the West, or in his reference, she entered the West 19 years before the first 20 blacks arrived at Jamestown. 19 years before the first 20 blacks arrived, the 20 Africans arrived at Jamestown. Concerned about her safety and her status on the northern frontier, Alvera gave a deposition to colonial officials in Mexico City, which said, in part, "I am going to New Mexico, and I have some reason to fear that I may be annoyed by some individuals since I am a mulatto. It is proper, therefore, for me to protect my rights in such an eventuality by an affidavit showing that I am a free woman, unmarried, and the legitimate daughter of Hernando, a Negro, and an Indian named Magdalena." She concluded her affidavit with three words: "I demand justice." I argue, folks, that that's the beginning of the civil rights struggle in the West. I also argue that here we have an articulate woman talking about her rights, defending her rights, as I said before the African-American experience begins in Virginia. Historical characters like Estevan and Alvera should be removed from what I call the contribution school of ethnic history and allowed to suggest the various possibilities for reconceptualizing the region's past. Estevan's travels, for example, initiated the meeting of Indian and Spanish cultures, which shaped much of the region's history. Notice I didn't say anything about blacks. It initiated the meeting of Indian and Spanish cultures. Without Estevan, the Spanish would not have traversed that area of what we now call the Southwest, and thus the history of that region would have been vastly different. On the other hand, Isabel de Alvera's statement suggests that she and perhaps hundreds of other Spanish-speaking black settlers who populated cities and towns, no, strike that, who founded cities and towns, ranging from Nacogdoches in Texas all the way to San Francisco and Santa Rosa in California. It suggests that these people were concerned about racial discrimination even in the first years of Spanish settlement. And, of course, their very presence confirms what I call the multicultural West as the meeting place of diverse peoples, diverse races, diverse cultures, long before the arrival of any English-speaking people. In other words, from the 17th through the 18th centuries, persons of African ancestry who migrated to what now constitutes the American West were far more likely to be Spanish speakers moving north from central Mexico rather than English speakers moving west from the Atlantic states. African-American history in the West often reveals what I call paradoxes and ironies, as in the case of Revolutionary-era Texas, where the liberty of Anglo slaveholders was in direct opposition to the freedom of black people. Now, I'm thinking that all of you have heard about the struggle for freedom in Texas. All of you have heard about the struggle of Davy Crockett and all of the other people at the Alamo to try to gain liberty from a tyrannical Mexico. Let me suggest that there's another story. And that other story is reflective of the African-American experience at this particular time. Mexico's Constitution in 1821 renounced black slavery and proclaimed political equality for all of the nation's inhabitants. That promise of freedom and equality proved the powerful attraction for fugitive slaves and for free blacks, quote, from the states. Remember, we're still talking about Texas as part of Mexico. The Sabin River, the border, the current border between Texas and Louisiana, became a political and racial frontier for a small number of intrepid African Americans who arrived in Mexican Texas in the 1820s. Many of these people were fugitive slaves, not surprisingly, but the immigrants also included a significant segment of free blacks who were determined to live under what they considered as Mexican liberty rather than U.S. tyranny. One of those free blacks was Samuel H. Hardin. He and his wife moved to Mexican Texas in 1822 because, and I'll use his words, the Mexican government's laws invited our immigration and guaranteed our right to own property. Folks, this was happening at a time when, as many of you know, the rights of free blacks were being constantly restricted, systematically being restricted in places like Virginia or in places like New York, as the case might be in the 1820s, 1830s, and 1840s. The warm view that blacks held toward Mexican Texas was reinforced, at least initially, by the attitude of the government of Mexico City. Listen to the words of Mexican Vice President Valentin Gomez, who said in 1833, in support of the relocation of former slaves in Mexico, quote, if they, meaning the U.S. blacks, would like to come, we will offer them land for cultivation, plots for houses where they can establish towns, and tools for work under the obligation that they will obey the laws of Mexico. Under the obligation that they will obey the laws of Mexico. Yet the aspirations of African Americans and their supporters for a free, racially tolerant Texas soon conflicted with the goals of Southern white planters to turn this Mexican province into an empire for slavery. By 1835, Texas slaveholders, most of whom were from the Old South, had duplicated the slave system of the United States, increasing the servile population to about 10% of English-speaking Texans. With growing numbers of slaveholders demanding the protection of their property while openly selling black slaves in defiance of Mexican law, it's no question that Anglo-Texans and the Mexican government were on a collision course, and of course that collision course would eventually lead to the Alamo. African Americans would soon be engulfed in the tumultuous creation of independent Texas. But for many of these African Americans, and particularly for the slaves, the flag of Mexico, rather than the Texas Revolutionary's Lone Star, seemed to be the banner of liberty. In February of 1836, 1 month before his siege of the Alamo, General Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna, commander of the Mexican army, queried government officials in Mexico City about the liberation of the slaves in Texas. He said, and I quote, "Shall we permit those wretches to moan in chains any longer in a country whose kind laws protect the liberty of man without distinction of caste or color," unquote. This is his answer from the central government in Mexico City. The philanthropy of the Mexican nation has already freed the slaves. Santa Anna is ordered to allow them to go any place they want or to stay in Texas. Folks, at that point, the Mexican army was poised to be a legion of liberation. We often think about the Union Army marching from the North into the South and freeing the slaves. But I would suggest to you in Texas, it was the army that was marching up from central Mexico that was about to bring liberty to a whole host of black people. And of course, those who were about to deny that liberty, who wanted to deny that liberty, were very clear on what was happening as well. Listen to the words of one Texas slaveholder who wrote this right after the Alamo. Quote, "Our Negroes are on the tiptoe of expectation and rejoicing now that the Mexicans are coming to make them free. Now that the Mexicans are coming to make them free. Of course, the Mexican army crossed the Colorado and Brazos rivers into central Texas. They moved into the region that was heavily populated by the slaves. And the boldest of those bonds people took flight towards Santa Anna's forces, both when they marched into Texas and even when they retreated from Texas after the Battle of San Jacinto. In return for Mexican protection, these fugitives served as spies, as messengers, or as provocateurs for their liberators. Now, ultimately, as we all know the story, the Texas revolutionaries were able to prevail. They were able to defeat the Mexican army. And in the process, they set in motion forces that would eventually not just wrestle Texas away from Mexico, but eventually all of what we call the American Southwest. But the other part of this story is that the victory of the Texas revolutionaries would fix African slavery as the predominant labor system in Texas. With the guarantee of government protection, Texas's peculiar institution grew from 3,000 African Americans in 1835 to 250,000 slaves 3 decades later. And folks, to put this in perspective, by the time of the Civil War, only Virginia had more slaves than Texas. Texas had indeed, by that point, become that empire for slavery that some of the slaveholders had wanted. Smaller numbers of slaves resided in every other western state and territory before 1860, including California, Colorado, and Oregon. Sometimes I have difficulty persuading many of my students that slavery existed in places like Olympia, Washington, or Berkeley, California, and on and on. But I think they're coming around to my position as we present more and more evidence. But I would also argue that Western slaveholders were not able to establish slavery for a whole host of reasons, not the least of which is the fact that there was a dedicated minority of white and black abolitionists in the West who did everything they could, particularly in California and Kansas, to undermine that peculiar institution. Indeed, throughout the 1850s, California slaves and anti-slavery activists often worked side by side in the mining fields, the mining camps, or on city streets in places like Sacramento and San Francisco. As I suggested before, it's difficult to imagine slaves walking the streets of Berkeley. It's hard for me to imagine slaves walking the streets of Berkeley. It's even harder to imagine abolitionists from Oakland saving those slaves or rescuing those slaves from slavery. It's hard for me to imagine, although it is true, that there were advertisements for runaway slaves in the San Francisco Chronicle or in the San Jose Mercury News. In other words, the newspapers that we come to identify with California at one point were reflective of the institution of slavery. Yet the proximity of slave and abolitionists exposed the bond servants to direct contact with their champions, a position that, of course, was virtually unknown here in Boston and in the East. That proximity also heightened the sense of urgency among anti-slavery activists who on a daily basis witnessed the horror of the servile institution. In other words, and I'll do a rough analogy, imagine if you can, slaves living in Boston and let's say Garrison living down the street from them, and imagine what he would do to try to bring about an end to the institution of slavery in that kind of setting. That was the situation in San Francisco in the 1850s. Peter H. Lester, a former Philadelphia abolitionist residing in San Francisco, was one of the people who became part of that struggle to liberate slaves who were his neighbors. Essentially, even though he was a prosperous businessman, he put it all on the line to bring fugitive slaves into his home to rescue them from the institution of slavery. And when I say rescue them, I mean he not only brought them into his home and supposedly hid them, but he more importantly talked to them about their rights as free people in California. And as importantly, he connected them with people in the legal profession who were willing to donate their time and services to bring about the freedom of these people. As Lester said, when they left, meaning when they left his home, we had them strong in the spirit of freedom. They were leaving slavery every day. In other words, his abolitionist activity was direct. and it involved the freeing of slaves, freeing of black people every single day. The challenge to slavery also came from the slaves themselves. Indeed, nowhere is this more in evidence than in Kansas. Black Kansas was created, literally created, by escaping slaves. In 1860, there were only 620 African Americans in all of Kansas Territory. By 1865, there were well over 12,000 black people there. They comprised about 9% of the population, which is a much larger percentage than blacks comprise of the Kansas population today. The explosion of Kansas's black population can be explained by a combination of politics and geography. As a sparsely populated territory adjacent to the Missouri counties, unfortunately, we don't have a map, but visualize in your mind's eye the border between Kansas and Missouri, Missouri being obviously to the east, Kansas to the west, the line running south from directly from Kansas City. Just to the east of that line on the Missouri side were the counties that had proportionally the largest numbers of slaves, the largest numbers of slaves. To the west of that line was Kansas and freedom. And it's not surprising, then, that a number of black slaves were going to try to make their way into Kansas. But even before they began to be involved in that process themselves, abolitionists, mostly white, but some black abolitionists as well, took charge of the situation. Indeed, as early as 1856, there were stations of the Underground Railroad in a variety of places in Kansas, including, most importantly, Lawrence, Kansas. Also, by 1858, there were major abolitionist figures operating in Lawrence, Kansas, people like James H. Lane, James Montgomery, and, of course, John Brown. These men led bands of Jayhawkers into Missouri in 1857, 1858, 1859, 1860, in raids that physically freed black people. As far as I know, and we can get into this in the discussion session, but as far as I know, this is the only place in antebellum America where white men were literally putting their lives on the line to go into slave territory to rescue black women and men, and to bring them back to freedom. We know of Harriet Tubman in the East, but we don't know of any large numbers of white men who were engaged in that activity anywhere else. But far more slaves acted on their own, making their way to the Kansas-Missouri border and then ultimately to Lawrence, which was, quote, the best advertised anti-slavery town in the world, according to one Kansas historian. I don't know if that's the case, but I'll use his words. I will say this, Lawrence definitely wanted, even though it was in close proximity to the Missouri border and slaveholders, Lawrence wanted its political allegiance to be known. It named its main street Massachusetts Avenue. And of course, at that particular point, to do so is to proclaim your political position, to proclaim the fact that you are anti-slavery. Freedom for these bondspeople in Missouri, unlike their counterparts in Mississippi or South Carolina, lay with a short dash to the west rather than a long journey through the slaveholding states to the north. Henry Clay Bruce recounted how he and his fiancée escaped from Missouri to Kansas in 1863. Bruce strapped around his waist, quote, a pair of Colt revolvers and plenty of ammunition. I should say he took both of them. He expropriated both of them from his master, and he made the run to the western border. Now, these are his words, not mine. I used to think that was from a Taco Bell commercial, but literally these are the words he used. He made the run to the western border. He said, and I'm quoting here, we avoided the main road, and we made the entire trip at night without meeting anyone. We crossed the Missouri River on a ferry boat to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. Then and only then did I feel myself a free man. Many of Kansas's black and white residents welcomed these fugitives. Some white abolitionists and a lot of black abolitionists rolled up their sleeves in preparation for those black Kansans who were flowing into the state to become good citizens. They opened schools, they opened churches, they opened or created work opportunities to help these blacks who were fleeing slavery to integrate into the society, into the economy. After the Civil War, for the first time, black people, the vast majority of black people, could go anywhere they wished, and many of them began to look to the west. Indeed, on the 1,000-mile frontier stretching from North Dakota to Oklahoma, African-American homesteaders, propelled by what I call the twin desires for land and political freedom in the west, confronted the broad, treeless Great Plains. Now, again, I want you to take your mind's eye to Kansas or to Oklahoma or to Nebraska at this particular moment. Unlike what we see here in Kansas in the 1860s or 1870s, particularly in central Kansas, you could look at tableland, you could look at flat land, and you could see land that had virtually no trees at all. As a matter of fact, the standing joke in one county, the county where Nicodemus was going to be located, was that you could see what your neighbors were doing in the next county. And that was, of course, because there were absolutely no trees. But nonetheless, this could be very intimidating, as you're going to see in a minute. The Langston City Herald, the newspaper for the most famous black town, all black town in Oklahoma Territory, proclaimed this much in 1893 when it called on Southern blacks to settle in the freedom, in the relative freedom of Oklahoma Territory. It said, and I'm quoting here, I'm quoting the newspaper, everyone that can should go to the Cherokee Strip and get 160, meaning 160 acres. All you need is a Winchester, a frying pan, and the $15 filing fee. Western civil rights activists, blacks, whites, Asian Americans, Native Americans, all of these groups employed sit-ins, economic boycotts, protest marches, and other forms of nonviolent demonstration to confront the three major grievances facing the black community at that time: job discrimination, housing bias, and de facto school segregation. As in the South, the direct action efforts of these activists did not eliminate all of the racial grievances. Nonetheless, the campaign demolished decades-old barriers to opportunity and equality. Moreover, that campaign in the 1950s and the 1960s confirmed what 19th-century black Westerners had known all along, that the struggle for racial justice was not simply a Southern campaign. It had to be waged in every corner of the nation, including the American West.
University of Washington history professor Quintard Taylor. Earlier, we heard from Professors Bruce Shulman and Anna Geifman of Boston University on how events become history and how the historical perspective of said events may change as time passes. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15 and include shipping and handling. To learn more about Boston University's World of Ideas, visit our website at buwi.org. Tonight's program was produced by Vince Fairchild, with help from John Hoder, Michael Garth, and Keith Infantino. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.
This is WBUI.